podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a guest this week who I have long wanted to interview. He is best known in the world as a novelist. He wrote the cult cycling classic, The Rider. He also wrote the book, which is known in English as The Vanishing. It was adapted into film both in the U.S. and in the Netherlands as separate films. He's also a journalist and a chess journalist. He's interviewed Kasparov. He's written for New in Chess magazine. He's rated in the 2200s FIDE. He was a top 20 player in the Netherlands who competed in two Dutch national chess championships. And in the early 2000s, he was a renowned chess blogger with a particular interest in chess endgame studies. He's also a cycling enthusiast, as his novel, The Rider, might suggest. And I am excited to speak with him. One quick note, we are doing this via Skype to phone. So I hope the sound quality is okay, but I think it will be worth it to hear from our guests. So without further ado, Tim Krabbe, thank you for joining us.
Okay, I'm fine with that.
So Tim and I both got our second vaccines within the last few days. So Tim, you reported that you're feeling okay?
I'm quite all right. Yeah, I had my second shot yesterday, and I didn't feel any side or after effects, so I'm quite okay.
Good. Well, congratulations. I know it's been a long time coming, and hope that everyone listening either has been or is working on getting vaccinated so that we can get back to real life. Yeah. So Tim, I want to talk about your writing. I want to talk about cycling, even though I don't know much about it. And of course, I would like to talk about chess. But since you haven't been blogging as actively in recent years, my first question was just, how into chess you are these days? Obviously, as we record, the candidates recently concluded. Do you still follow events like that?
Yes, I'm quite into chess these days. I follow all the internet tournaments, and of course, I follow the candidates tournaments practically from day to day and glued to the screen when things got really tense. And it was a wonderful tournament, I think. It was very exciting to see my compatriot Geary really be in contention for the first place, and it was a pity he didn't make it in the end.
Yeah, he was so close. I would have enjoyed seeing him take on Magnus as well. So when you have your eyes glued to the screen, as you say, do you typically watch broadcasts or just let the moves unfold on their own?
I just follow it. I never switch to the commentator's channel because I can't stand the noise, really, and they're laughing too much, I think. I'm just following the moves, and I look at the computer analysis. And I must say, I quite like Geary, but I'm not a very chauvinistic guy when it comes to chess. I love chess itself more than I love my country, so I was quite happy that Nepo won this tournament and will be the next challenger. I think he's a very interesting player, and he's also something, I don't know if you really know this word in English, an Eisgegner for Carlsen. He has a positive score against him. So I think of all the eight guys who played this tournament, he was the guy who might make it the most difficult for Carlsen in their match later this year, I believe, in November.
Yeah, that's right. It will be in November, and it will be an interesting clash of styles. So what else are you doing in terms of chess these days, Tim? In your legendary blog, Chess Curiosities, which, by the way, Tim has an out-of-print amazing book by the same name, you often would talk about playing Blitz on ICC in those days. Are you still playing online Blitz much, Tim?
I'm not writing chess anymore these days, but I follow chess closely. I still get a lot of emails that pertain to my website and sometimes to my book with new examples of all kinds of things. but I do not use them anymore. I just use them for my own pleasure, which I will communicate to the people who sent them to me. So I'm not adding to that anymore, but I still, as I said, I'm following all the important tournaments. I read a lot about chess. I read many chess sites every day. So I'm quite into chess a lot, and sometimes I play my stupid putzer games on some of the chess servers. So, but that's very, as you know, probably it's very addictive. So I try to cut down on that. But sometimes I do play for hours on end on the internet. But it's been years since I played any serious chess.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people listening would love to play, as you say, stupid patzer games at your level. You beat Grandmaster Donner in one of the Dutch championships. And of course, you have tons of stories from playing legends and simuls and interviewing legends. And I'd like to get to all that stuff in due time. But so I'm curious, Tim, if you're getting all these submissions for stuff like the Babson Task, which listeners can look up, and these other sort of very erudite type chess studies, what prevents you from dropping a post on the blog, which is still up for people to read once in a while?
What do I do about the Babson Task, you mean? I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't phrase that very well. Why not write an occasional post if you're still getting emails about this stuff?
Well, you know, if I were two persons, one of them would be writing still a lot about chess curiosities, but only one. And I think I had really done my best. I've written everything that I thought was interesting. And I have other things in life to do, which in the first place is writing novels. I'm working on a new novel now. So I think I more or less put a stop to working on my chess curiosity site. Every now and then I do a little something about it, but mainly I don't add to that anymore. But there are hundreds of stories there, so that should be enough for anyone interested in chess curiosities.
Yes, the listeners, I definitely recommend you check it out and be prepared to get lost for many days in the archive that Tim has accumulated. Now, Tim, we were put in touch by Tom Vanderbilt, the author of Beginners, who has been on the podcast. Thank you, Tom, for doing that. And I read a feature that he wrote of you a few years back where you alluded to the fact that you've been working on a big novel. Is that the project that you mentioned, or do you have something else in the works now?
I'm not sure. A few years back, I was working on a book that became an 800-page book about a very famous murder case in Holland, where I got to know the guy who did that and his whole family very well. I followed them intimately, you might say, for about 30 years. And it's really a chronicle about a family in hard times, you might say, and also in bad times, of course. And that's what I published 2 years ago now, and I'm working on a novel. I have been working on it for over a year now, and it's a rather ambitious and complicated work, so I'll be happy if it could come out in 2023.
Okay.
Let's not be overly optimistic.
Good, yeah. And you're...
But that's what I'm working on now.
Great. And you're 78 years of age, is that right, Tim?
I'm 78, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And Tom reported from cycling with you that you were in vigor, like quite vigorous still, very healthy. Do you feel like you're holding up well and able to still work very hard?
I do quite a lot of riding, that's right. Maybe 250 or 300 kilometers a week, I think. I think it's a very healthy thing to do. So, of course, I'm not racing anymore, but I did race with a Masters of 60 and over for almost 10 years in my, what I call my second cycling career, starting when I was 62 or something. And I did that until I was almost 70. I don't do races, of course, anymore now, but I still do a lot of long rides too. Last week I did one of 150 kilometers, and that went really well. So I feel healthy, and I hope to be able to go on with that for many years to come.
That's amazing to hear. That's inspiring. And Tim, we have a lot of listeners who are still working to get better at chess, whether they be in their 60s, when you had your renaissance as a bike racer, or a bit younger. So what advice would you have for staying strong at an endeavor like cycling? And of course, any applications we could apply to chess would also be welcome.
I don't think there are very many similarities between cycling or whatever and chess. Chess is just chess. But of course, it helps to be in good shape and to be sharp. I think almost all of these guys nowadays do a lot of sports to be in good shape, in good physical shape. For one thing, Carlsen is a good example. He's very good at various ball sports, especially. And the olden days when the chess world champions were 40 to 50 years old and did not do much physical training are over, I think. It's an important thing to stay in good shape. And that makes you think clearer, I think. But there are not many similarities to chess and cycling. They just happen to be interesting sports, both of them. And if you are, if you like sports, you might just accidentally happen onto both of them, but they don't have any common things. Except for one thing, I always in cycling when I did races, I noticed that the massive sprints, the bunch sprints, made me feel a lot like time trouble in chess did. You have to make decisions for which you have only a split second, and they are all decisive. So the frenzy of a bunch sprint and the frenzy of time trouble are very comparable, I think.
Oh, that's interesting. I could totally see that. Now, I have to admit, I can barely ride a bike, Tim, but I did read The Rider. I enjoyed it because I enjoy glimpses into subcultures, and I know that you've mentioned in the interview with Tom that's you try to be faithful to sort of the micro world. You're not trying to make like grand illusions. You're just trying to present this little world as it is. And I really appreciated that. And you say that there's not that many similarities between chess and cycling. But one line that struck me was you mentioned that cyclists always say that the best part of cycling is the suffering. And I think there's an element of that in slow tournament chess as well.
Well, there is a lot of suffering in chess as well. I mean, when you realize that you have made a blunder or you have played a bad move, and just after you made it, you see how bad it is, and you think of the better move that you could have made, that's some sort of suffering, you might say. And you know, in cycling, the concept of suffering is something very popular. It makes us heroes, you know. We can tell we were suffering such a lot. But at the same time, every rider, and I think every endurance sportsman, knows that as soon as you cross the finish line, the suffering turns into a remembrance of pleasure. It's paradoxical. The suffering is pleasure. In a way. And also when you talk about suffering in cycling, I noticed that for a short while I did both sports at a certain level. I noticed that after a serious chess game, which could take 5 to 7 hours, I was much more tired than I was after a cycling race. After a cycling race, I felt tired, of course, a bit, but in a different way, in a fresher way than after a hard game of chess. So that's the physical aspect of chess, which is maybe often underestimated. There is a comparison there between chess and between all sports. You suffer because it costs you energy, and that's not different in chess. It's very often not seen as a real sport by many people, which is okay with me, but it's a physical thing to do, chess.
Yeah, that's an amazing insight. I, of course, am not a scientist, but maybe it's something to do with the fact that you have the mental release of this energy, but there's no physical release. So holding that in might be more exhausting than even something as grueling as a cycling race.
Not every cycling race is that grueling. I mean, I think writers and writers about it propagate the idea that is very grueling. But in a professional race, let's say of 200 kilometers, It will be not be so very hard for at least 150 kilometers. They just ride in a bunch, and it's quite easy to follow at times. Of course, in the last tour hour or 2 hours, then it becomes really grueling. But chess is also grueling. You really get very tired. And I can also compare this to writing. After a full day of writing, I'm also very tired, in a different way from tiredness after cycling.
And it's more similar to chess?
Writing is similar to chess. I mean, the brain works in a top function, you might say. Thinking is hard. Thinking spends a lot of energy, and it really makes you tired. If you're really thinking hard, whether it's on chess or on writing, doesn't make that much difference.
Interesting. Well, Tim, we've got a few more questions from listeners of the podcast related to the intersection of cycling and chess. It turns out we've got some cycling enthusiasts listening. So first, I'm going to get to those in a second, but first I'd like to take a break and hear from our sponsors, Chessable.com. This is your weekly reminder that Chessable.com has a ton of high-quality material. Whether you're looking to learn a certain opening, want to see the latest Super GM repertoire that has been published, want to find a tactics course appropriate for your level, whatever it may be, go to Chessable.com and have a look around. Don't forget they have tons of cool free content too, like their short and sweet courses about various openings. And all of the things that they offer feature their proprietary move trainer technology, the secret sauce that lets you actually remember all of the new chess moves and opening sequences that you learn. So once again, Chessable.com, check out their ever-expanding excellent library. And we are back. So, Tim, the first question is from a friend and supporter of the podcast, Dima Spivak. Thanks for the support, Dima. Now, Dima, you already touched on this answer, but he goes a little deeper because he's talking about professional cyclists. So I'll just read Dima's question, which is, besides you, of course, there are some other famous examples of top-level cyclists who also play chess, Mark Cavendish being the first to come to mind. What is it about these two activities that makes them appealing to the same types of people? So I know you've said that you don't think it's necessarily the case, but have you noticed this amongst top-level cyclists?
I don't know. I don't know any top-level cyclists who really play chess. I didn't know, in fact, I must confess that Cavendish played chess, but I don't think at a very high level, or I would have known. In my surroundings, there were a few guys who were decent riders and also decent chess players. But at top levels, there are not many examples of great chess players who are also great sportsmen. One example, of course, it's not with cycling, but with football, is Simon Agnestein, the Norwegian grandmaster. He was among the 20 best chess players in the world, and at the same time, he played in the Norwegian national soccer team. So he's the outstanding example of that. And I don't know of any cyclists or cycle racers who were top racers and also top chess players. It hasn't happened.
Yeah, I was aware, of course, of Simon Agnestein, his achievements as a top footballer, and then becoming Magnus's trainer subsequently. But it was interesting reading through your blog archive in preparation for this interview that you've been tracking this story for decades. You had him sending you notes in like the late 90s, so that was pretty cool to see.
Yeah, well, I interviewed Agnestein about this, and he was always considering whether he should stop with one career or with the other. And in the end, he was, in a way, you might say, helped by the fact that he got an injury which prevented him from going on with his football career. So, he was not really the ultimate top in chess as well, and he became a trainer. And he was the first real serious trainer of Carlsen, of course.
Yeah, and of course, I'm sure it doesn't hurt that chess is booming in Norway. And I believe he still runs the same chess school that Magnus attended as a youngster.
I think, Agnestein was the first chess grandmaster in Norway. Yeah.
Yeah, so an amazing legacy and incredible to reach that level in such different pursuits. And the next listener question is from Alan Su. Alan asks, he says, what have you learned from chess that helped you develop and maintain your cycling ability and fitness and vice versa?
I have a very disappointing answer. Nothing. I don't know. There, as I said, there are no transfers there. There are transfers in similar sports. Let's say cyclists very often skate and they row and sometimes they run. And there, of course, there are transfers in strengths. In chess, you have go and maybe bridge and checkers, and people who excel at chess could also excel at those things and might even profit from their expertise in one of those other games. But between physical sports and mind sports, I don't think there's any transfer in knowledge or expertise.
Well, Tim, what about the fact that you became really good at three different things? That's something that not a lot of people can say. Some people don't become as an accomplished a novelist as you are, a top 20 chess player in your country, and an accomplished cyclist as well. So there, even if it's not direct, there must be something that you've learned about getting good at things.
I'm very sorry, but I don't know. The fact that you say that I'm a competent chess player, and I'm only a writer and a chess player as far as I have written about it. Foremost, I'm just a writer. And I've written about many things that interest me in life, among which are cycling and chess playing. But as a chess player, I've meant absolutely nothing in a broader sense. And also as a cyclist, I've also meant nothing. I mean, in cycling, perhaps I was once among the 200 best in Holland. In chess, for a short while, I was among the 20 best. But that's only known. You're only doing this interview with me because I wrote about those things.
I get what you're saying. It's a fair point. I'm just saying.
Okay.
Most people don't reach the top 20 of anything.
Too easy to see any similarities or whatever between chess and cycling. They're just, I mean, if you have the personality that likes silly games, then you might take up as a cycling as well as chess. What is chess? You shove around wooden puppets and, but in the end you might win. And to be attracted by winning is what all sports have in common, of course. And then it depends on which sport you meet in your life. And that's just a matter of sheer luck, of course. But I don't have any real talent in chess or in cycling, but I hope I have some real talent in writing.
Well, your reputation speaks for itself. And I get your point. I get what you're saying, but but I still think you sell yourself short in chess. Now, in an old interview, Tim, you mentioned that when you were in your 20s, you knew that you loved chess, but you felt like you just weren't going to be quite good enough to pursue it professionally. Could you expand upon that a bit? Tell us about what went into that decision.
Well, I remember one thing very clearly. When I was 14, I was madly in love with chess. I was dreaming about becoming world champion, and I did not know much about the history or the practice of chess. And then a member of our family who knew I was playing chess gave me a clipping from a newspaper, and in it said that a boy who was exactly my age, named Bobby Fischer, had become champion of the United States. And I, at that same time, I was struggling to become champion of my school. And that was the moment that I thought that maybe there was a difference between me and people who had real talents. I was really trying to become champion of school and failing at it as well. And Bobby Fischer was champion of the United States. So there it was. That guy had talent and I did not really have that kind of talents. Let's put it that way. So Fischer, who is just a few weeks, who was a few weeks older than me, was my was some sort of a marker for me that made it clear to me that I hadn't the makings of a world champion in me.
Well, that's good perspective for a 14-year-old. So Tim, you, speaking of Fischer, you attended the match of the century, correct?
I do what? Say it again, please.
Did you go to the Fischer-Spassky match in Reykjavik?
Yes, yes, yes. I was there as a journalist, and I even spoke to Fischer on the night he was crowned as a world champion. I'm not a great small talker, and it was only small talk, but I remember he was sitting at a long table. If you've ever seen pictures of that night, you know what I'm talking about. And a girl I knew, an Icelandic girl, had managed to come up to him, which was maybe a little bit easier for a girl than for me. And when she saw me standing somewhere around her, she beckoned me, come over. So what I could do, I mean, all the tables were guarded by guards. It was impossible to approach Fischer. But I dove under those tables, and I crawled all along the hall where this ceremony was. And I reached Fischer and this girl, and I took a chair next to him. And then this girl said, "Oh, hello, Bobby. This is Tim. He also plays chess."
That's great.
And then we exchanged a few words. So I can say that I did speak to Bobby Fischer on the night at the banquet where his world championship was celebrated. Of course, that match was absolutely exciting because of his strength and his odd behavior.
Yeah. So before we get back to the match, did Fischer seem interested in the girl?
I think Fischer was always interested in girls. Of course, the fact that she had managed to come over to him means that he was interested in girls. There are interesting, nice pictures of Fischer that night dancing, even with an Icelandic girl. Not that girl I'm talking about, but another girl who was there. Fischer was, in his own way, a woman's man, I think.
Yeah, I know that Barbara Streisand has said that she had a crush on him when they went to high school together. But yeah, I mean,
Not sure. Are you sure about the crush? I know they went both to Erasmus College or Erasmus High School in Brooklyn, but I don't know about the crush. I'm not even sure that they knew each other at school. But they both went there, and I think they were about the same age.
Yeah. So tell us more about that match, Tim. Was it just like throngs of people everywhere? Like, what was the day-to-day life like at that match?
What it was to be there, it was the center of the chess world. It was going to be evidently the most famous chess match ever played between an eccentric and a very nice gentleman from Russia. And it started with 2-0 for Spassky, as you know, because Fischer didn't show up for the second game, and he played very strangely in the first game, about which I have a theory, which is probably incorrect, but chess players will remember that Fischer buried his own bishop on h2. In that game, and the bishop couldn't, it was a very odd thing to play, and that happened on the 29th move, and Fischer was 29 years old at that time, and I, maybe a little bit too Freudian, saw it as some sort of a suicide. He played for a loss, really. It was an incomprehensible move on the 29th move, so he committed suicide at 29, you might say, chessically. And then he didn't show up for the second game, and everybody thought it's over. I remember people were absolutely, I remember talking to Olafsson there, who was the strongest Icelandic player at the time, and nobody thought he would come back, and of course it was had been very difficult already to get him there. And it was a miracle that he, for some reason, showed up for the third game, and then the rest is history.
Yeah, yeah. Just amazing to hear you talk about it. And What Tim is referring to is, for any listeners not familiar, if you look up game one of the 1972 Fischer-Spassky World Championship, Fischer played this very famous blunder where he took a pawn on h2 and allowed his bishop to be trapped. And to this day, people debate what it was that he missed. There might have been one move, four moves down the line that he missed that didn't allow the bishop to get out, or it might have just been a bigger brain fart, or it could have been the superstitious forces at work that Tim refers to. But in any event, it's great, Tim, to hear your stories from being there. So, Tim, we've got one more.
Well.
Sorry.
You still there?
Yeah, I am. Sorry. I just wasn't sure if you had something to add. But we have one more cycling question before we get back to chess, although it's also related to chess.
Sure.
So this one is from Patreon subscriber Aryan Duvapov. Aryan asks, he says, how important do you think physical exercise is for our chess skills? I know you've mentioned this at the elite level. Research says regular exercise changes the brain to improve memory and thinking skills. Do you think amateur chess players should get on the bike?
Not especially on the bike, but it's been proven, I guess, that physical exercise is very good for chess players to be in top shape. And I don't think that cycling is not a very economic sport if you do it to get in shape, because it's a sitting sport, actually. That it has that in common with chess. In chess, you sit at the board. In cycling, you sit on the saddle. If you want to build up a good physical shape, you could better go running, I think. It's in an hour, you will spend more energy than you will on a bike in 2 or 3 hours. So if you want to do it economically, go and run.
Okay, yeah, and that's what you did when you came back to cycling in your 60s, right? You started out by jogging?
Exactly. I wanted to take up, I was at least 30 kilos overweight, and I wanted to start cycling again. And I thought the most economical way to build up some semblance of a shape was to go running, which I did for half a year or something. And only then I started cycling again. Cycling is a quite different sport from running. Running is harder. Measured in the same amounts of time, of course. In an hour of running brings you more than 2 hours of cycling.
And Tim, as someone who's relying on your brain to earn a living and tell your stories into your late 70s, and someone who's still very, very physically active, are you watching what you eat as well and eat and drink, or are you more focused on the physical training? I'm just curious.
No, I'm just taking it easy. I'm not following any regime. I'm just eating what I like. It's on the healthy side, I must say, but I don't eat too many sweets these days. That's the only thing that I changed when I came back to physical sports. I drink a normal amount of alcohol, which is one or two glasses a day, but just because I don't like to drink any more than that. I'm not following any special regimen, which I also didn't when I was still a competitive racer. I'm not interested in diets, etc.
Yeah, good to hear, because I'm really not.
And it seems I don't need them as well, so I'm keeping at a reasonable weight last 10 or 20 years. So, but I weighed, I think, 20 years ago, 110 kilos or something. And now I'm around 80, which
wow.
is better.
Yeah, amazing. Good stuff. Well, Tim, I want to hear some more chess stories, but first we're going to take one more break to hear from our friends at aimchess.com.
Not every chess player has a janitor to help them improve at chess like Beth Harmon did. For those of you who don't, there is aimchess.com. Aimchess has a web-based algorithm that collects and analyzes your games from chess.com or Lee Chess, and then it creates personalized study plans based on your weaknesses to help you improve. It might highlight specific openings to work on, tell you to tighten up your tactics, or in my case, tell me to manage my time better. Then it gives you puzzles and advice with the goal of helping you improve your chess faster. You can check out Aim Chess for free. And then if you decide to subscribe, please use the promo code CHESS30 to save 30%. That's CHESS30. The details are also in the show notes. So for now, let's get back to the interview.
So, Tim, you've got so many amazing stories on your blog. Playing Karpov in a blindfold simul, you tell a great story involving playing Anand in a simul at the same time that you're getting romantically involved with a girl. Meeting a young Jan Timman as he bursts onto the Dutch chess scene. So when you look back on all that you've seen in chess, what are your most treasured memories, Tim?
That's hard to say, a treasured memory, but maybe it's my visit to Leonid Jarosz in Kazan in Tatarstan, the guy who finally managed to compose the Betson task. But of course, that's not about chess as a contest. It's not about chess tournaments. But this Betson task, which you mentioned before here, was a problem that was very hard to compose, and which the greats in the world had tried to compose and nobody managed. And then suddenly there was a totally unknown guy from Kazan who had managed it in a beautiful way. I wrote a book about that, the man who wanted to make the Betson task. And meeting this guy, who was a very unassuming, sweet and nice guy in Kazan, was one of the highlights of my chess life.
Wow, that is not the answer I expected, although I know that you love the endgame study. So for listeners, you can look up a Babson task. Tim has written about it at length, and it's a story he's tracked over many years. But it is a composed endgame position, or a composed position, rather, that has certain stipulations, that white makes the only move that forces checkmate in a certain number of moves, that black's defense includes the promotion of a pawn to either a knight, bishop, rook, or queen, so under promotion. And if black promotes, then white must promote to the same piece that black just promoted to.
Exactly, yes.
Well,
that was very...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say it's... You know, chess, as you've sort of alluded to, chess to begin with is an abstraction. And then to devote as many hours to the Babson task as you and your followers and your compatriots have is like an abstraction on top of an abstraction. It's just, I love the dedication.
Well, for me, it's the Babson task is some sort of, you might say, a hallmark of the creative mind. Because you want to create something that's very hard to create, and you give years and years and years of your life to it, not being sure even if you will manage to create this. The Betson task is not only about Jarosz, who did it, but also about a Frenchman, a certain Pierre Drumard, who tried to compose this elusive problem, as he says, for 22 long years at 4 hours a day. He tried to achieve this fantastic position, and he did not make it. He did not realize his dream. And then there comes this unknown football trainer, which Jarosz wins, and he does it in, he just does it.
That's amazing. Wow. 22 years for 4 hours a day. That's crazy.
My efforts to compose the Betson task, my elusive efforts to compose the Betson task, that's what he titled his serial about that in a French problem magazine.
And are you still, so you say you keep up with top-level competitive chess. Are you still keeping up with sort of, you say people still email you, but are you still solving endgame studies and doing difficult work like that?
Do I still keep up with problems and studies, you said?
Yes.
Yeah, I follow, on the chess sites that I follow, there will be interesting problems and studies from time to time, and I look at them. And important things that happen in the chess study and the chess problems world, I also follow, yes.
So which sites do you like to keep up with, which chess sites?
I always look at, the Chess Base site and the Chess Vibes site. They have Well, actually, ChessBase will publish one of my old studies in some of the weeks to come, I think. Study about what I call the rambling rook. I'm not sure that you know what I mean. It's a rook that can keep on giving check until eternity and can never be captured because then it would be stalemate.
Right, yeah, I love those.
It was a phenomenon in you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It was a phenomenon in chess, what happens a lot in games, but also in studies, which interested me a lot. And I more or less worked out a theory about it. That resulted in one study, which ChessBase will publish again in one of their coming issues.
Excellent. I'll look forward to that. And Tim, obviously you've done your fair share of reading about chess and chess learning and, of course, chess history. What are some of your favorite chess books?
My favorite chess book is, I might say, one that I made myself. I collected together with a friend the writings of Hein Donner, the Dutch grandmaster. It's in Dutch it was called De Koning, which was translated into English as The King.
Yeah.
And The King is really, I think, the best chess book ever written. It's worth the trouble to learn Dutch to be able to learn to read it in Dutch, I think. But there is a translation, of course. Donner was a good grandmaster and a great writer, which he understood chess, but he was a really literary writer, you might say. He should be admired for his style and his wit, etc., etc. The things that you have that you admire real great writers for. So The King is my favorite chess book.
Yeah, absolute legendary book. And I know that a biography, I haven't had a chance to read it, but a biography of Donner came out in the past few years, Tim. I know that you knew him personally, but
yes.
Did you get a chance to read that as well?
I haven't read it. No, I must say I didn't read it, but I know so much about him already that I was not immediately tempted to read it. If I may mention it, another chess book that I really like very much is one about Mikhail Tal, The Life and Games of Mikhail Tal. That was my favorite chess player of all time.
Yeah, I mean, of course I have some guesses, but what is it about Tal that you love?
He was crazily entertaining in his games. He dared to do everything. He was the first fully undogmatic player. He was, let's say, he came up, he became good in a time when dogma, you might say, reigned in chess. And Tal wasn't interested in dogma. He was the first who saw chess as a game of chance, which in fact it really is. Of course, chance based on knowledge and based on capabilities, but he created difficult situations for him and for his opponent. It didn't really matter to him who was, in a higher sense, better in a position. What interested him in him was that it was an entertaining position and that it was difficult. And he was, and those were the sorts of positions that he was better in than the other guy. And he dared everything on the chessboard. So he was, he's not just for nothing that he's called the magician. He was a magician on the chessboard.
Wow, that was a very poetic description. And spot on, of course. So do you think a style like that would still work today in the engine age, Tim?
I'm not sure. I don't know that much about chess, but there are a lot of players these days who are also very creative. I'm thinking of Mamajaro, for instance. I'm thinking of Dubov and also occasionally Carlsen. I think, that's also the influence of the computer, of course. The computer has shown many new possibilities in the strategy of chess and also variations in the openings that were not thought to be playable at all, turn out to be playable after all. You can see it in the games, for instance, by Maxime Vacher-Lagrave, who plays things in the Poisson Point, font variation that were not possible just 10 years or 20 years ago. So I think the creative side of chess is not demolished by the computers. It's helped by the computers.
I'm glad to hear you say that. And of course, Tim, in this past year to year and a half during quarantine time, there's been a big push with more competitive events online with elite players playing. Do those hold your interest? And what do you think about the possible future of chess as sort of an e-sport, as they call it?
Well, chess, the internet chess is very interesting and very nice to follow. But of course, it's to shorten the games, make them more interesting, but also more superficial. I'm afraid that classic chess will have a very hard time to survive. And I think that maybe in the end, Fischer Random Chess will be a solution to that, because these guys play over tens of thousands of games, and one remark in the postmortems about games that you often see is that I forgot my analysis. I looked at this position, and I know that I have a winning line here or something, but I forgot the lines. They can't remember everything that they analyze, and the best thing would be to throw all openings theory overboard and play Fischer Random Chess or something like that, where there is no openings theory. Openings theory is bad for chess.
Yeah, when I interviewed your friend Grandmaster Jan Timman, he confirmed that if he were coming up today, he doesn't think he would be a chess professional because the amount of opening theory required to be known is just overwhelming.
Absolutely. It's there's too much to learn these days. And they already have to learn so much about strategy generally in the middle game, etc. But that applies also to the positions you will get with random. So my guess is that, let's say, 30 or 50 years from now, classic chess will be more or less dead, and Fischer or whatever random chess will be more played than classical chess.
That's interesting. And Tim, of course, chess has also seen a huge boom, not just at the elite level, but a broad-based surge in popularity with the combination of the people being at home and looking for new activities, and of course, Queen's Gambit. As someone who lived through the Fischer boom and saw it firsthand, how do you compare these booms? Do you think that chess is going to be able to maintain the popularity this time around?
Chess will certainly maintain its popularity. It's a great game. It gives people pleasure. It has many sides that appeal to the feeling of beauty that people have, also in problems and studies, of course, but certainly also in games. Chess is getting bigger and bigger all the time, and it will not, I don't see it ever really going down. It's a great pastime and a great art, and it's the best game there is, I think.
Yeah, I agree, but it's great to hear you say that. And Tim, your book, The Rider, so beloved by cyclists, a cult classic. Did you ever consider, and I read that you mentioned in an interview, you consider it, it's based on life, but it's a novel. Did you ever consider doing something similar for chess, related to chess?
In fact, I have done something like that for chess, which is a long, short story, which you can find on my website. It's called Master Jacobson. It's not as well known as The Rider is, but I think it's just as good. So if people want to know what I can say in fiction about chess, then they should read my story, Master Jacobson, on my site.
Okay. Yeah, I'll have to check that out. I that one escaped me. And Tim, this is my last sort of line of questioning, I would guess. Obviously, you've become, you've had quite a lot of success with your books in touching on, you know, whether it be The Rider, which represents a sort of microculture, or just telling stories, as you do in The Vanishing and some of your other works. What advice do you have for cultivating the skill of storytelling?
I'm just writing. My main maxim is that I want to write things that I'd like to read myself. I write for myself, in fact. I have no public in my mind at all. I just recently wrote something that was not even meant for publishing, which was just for me and my girlfriend, but to which I applied all the craft that I have just as well as for things that I write for publishing. It's, you know, the urge to create something. That's the first thing that you need. And publishing and making money from it are seconds and thirds. But now I'm working on a new novel to which I apply all my craft, but that is for publishing. But it's publishing, making money are not the first things. You have to feel this urge to create something worthwhile. And there, a good comparison is again with chess. Composing chess problems has exactly the same. You make no money from it. There's a very, very limited public for it. You just make them out of the urge to make something that works, that lives, that breathes.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing perspective. But of course, like most writers, I know that you've read your fair share of fiction. Do you have favorite writers that you maybe model yourself after or just look up to?
What I look up to are the great 19th century Russians. They all wrote in you could even say a prosaic style. They did not show off in their style. They had good stories to tell, and they if you read them now, they are completely modern. Their novels have not aged, and many other writers that you might perhaps admire have written things that have aged, and you can sometimes read contemporaries that you see that from which you see that they will age within a few years. But the great Russians, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Turgenev, etc., they are really eternal writers. Their books are just as modern as they were 150 years ago.
And as a professional writer, I studied Russian in college and took Russian literature course, so I read my share of those books and greatly enjoyed them, but
yes.
I never went back to them. But as a professional writer, do you reread them and deconstruct them the way you would in like analyzing a chess game, or are you able to just read, take something from it, and go to the next book?
Oh, no, I just read as an amateur reader, you know. I read for pleasure. I do not read to learn anything from books, if that's what you mean. I read for pleasure, yes. I'm not trying to copy or anything, or I don't look up to these guys because I can learn things from them. I look up to them because they're fantastically entertaining.
Excellent. That's a good perspective. Okay, Tim. Well, this has been a thrill. I just want to hear one more chess story before we go, if you don't mind. I'd love to hear the story of your walk with Kasparov that you've written about on your Chess Curiosities blog.
Yeah, it was very strange. It was in a tournament in Amsterdam in 1995, and he had missed a move. Again, I was already talking about that. Against Piquet, he had forgotten a move that he had analyzed. And for some reason, he wanted to show it to me. I was, of course, then the official tournament book writer, and he just went up to me and said, "Are you interested if knight a4, I think, if that move is in my computer?" I said, "Yes, of course." "Well, then come with me." And we walked through Amsterdam to his hotel, and he showed me all the secret variations, perhaps being sure that I could not remember them at all. these were really very costly secrets that he showed me, and he was just to show me that this move that he had forgotten was in his computer, but he couldn't find it in that computer. And then the meeting was over. I could go. But that was a very strange thing, because he knew me already, and he did not like me very much, because I had once written a very bad review about one of his books. But still, he wanted to make it known to the world that he had only missed this move that he should have played, and then he would have beaten Piquet, but now he had lost to Piquet.
That's an amazing story.
Very strange behavior.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've got to be wired differently to reach that level of the chess hierarchy, probably to be that good at anything. So Tim, I don't know if you have any other stories you'd like to share before you go, but this has been an absolute pleasure.
That's okay.
Okay.
Oh, you were asking if I have any more stories to share?
Yes.
I can tell you a little one if you want. Well, I was amazed once by Jan Timman. I know Jan Timman simply in circles that I move in. And one time I mentioned to him that we had played six official games, when he was in his teens and I was in my 20s. And that three of them he had won and the other three were draws. And I described five of those six games and I couldn't remember the sixth one. And he immediately knew that sixth game and he told me what it had been about, et cetera, et cetera. And that was amazing to me because for him that game had been completely unimportant. Of course, for me it had been an important game because I was playing against a future world-class player and he had been playing against the putter. But he remembered that game, move for move, move to move. That was amazing to me. That showed me how grandmasters remember and how grandmasters think.
Yeah, just amazing. And Tim, the sound has gotten a little faint, but so I'm not sure if that'll show up on the recording. But in any event, I just wanted to thank you for all your contributions to chess. You're very modest about them, but there's so many Chess Curiosities fans out there that will love to hear your stories and your thoughts about the chess world.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for letting me talk to you.
My pleasure. And people can still email you through Chess Curiosities, right? Through the blog?
That site will still be there. I'm not taking it down or anything. I'm just not adding to it, but all those stories are still there to read, and most of them are in English.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you.
Thanks, as always, to my producer, Matthew Passy. Thanks to you all for listening. And thanks to those of you who help spread the word, whether it be positive reviews on podcast platforms, telling friends, social media, all that stuff helps get the word out and it is much appreciated. By the way, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFishel1. You can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group to continue the conversation, sometimes even with that week's guests. The Perpetual Chess Instagram page is back in action as well at Perpetual Chess. And you can also find all these links on the Perpetual Chess webpage, perpetualchesspod.com. But of course, the main purpose of these closing credits is to thank everyone who supports Perpetual Chess financially. Without you all, we would not be able to put out such a consistent and hopefully quality product. So thanks so much. It really means the world to me. And in particular, I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities, starting off with my friends at chessable.com. Aside from that, I would like to thank David Lazarus of lasmanchess.com. He is the coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, our friends at Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, the Apprend Chess Twitch channel, A Needy Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porto, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess blog, chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Eric Tam, Ewan Richardson, Farhan Thawar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, Guvin Monet, James Holyhead, James Kennedy, Jeff Martinson, Jens Green, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, King Selt, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, one of the original chess YouTube channels, Lucio Casada Silva, the law offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the legendary Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnase Twitch channel, GM Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodhi, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Reuven Fisher, Reverend Roy Fry, the Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of Strong Chess, Todd Kennedy, the Vintage Patsers, which is a chess.com improver group. You can look them up. Wayne Bean, William Hogarth, and I also would like to thank Aaron Waffler, Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of chessengland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovics, Antonio Cancino, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Chad Hilton, Chess Potzer Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, also known as Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Corey Butson, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Bleskacek, David Brown, David Hamblin, David Cramley, Dalen Shelton, Dennis Parrish, Dirk Decker, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Emmanuel Langual, Robitaille, Ethan Smith, Hallelujah Cat, Ian Mason, Fide Arbiter, Felipe Melo Pereira, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letart Lavoie, Dr. Frank Tortoris, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Geert Vanderveld, Gene Stewart, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Hans Schut, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Parry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse DeCumos, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John Tooley, Juan Almaguar, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman of US Chess, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, GM Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, I am Kostya Kovutsky of the Chess Dojo, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Reiforth, Laura Belyavsky, Macaulay Peterson, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovic, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Goble, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigmat Malijanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited in Switzerland, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Tichy, Robert Turner, Rory Coleman, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott McKinnon, Scott Shepard, Sean Kraus, Sebastian Finsterwater, Walter, Sergey Magakon, Seth Ruzicka, Shane Unger, Silver Knights in Richmond, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatyav Abrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tom Edsel, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rattel, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Chang of Chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we will catch you all next week.
Sports Social Podcast Network.